All right, it's me again. This is my 32nd podcast already since I re-began the There Is a Way Out. My name is Bromo. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 2/17/09. It is the 26th of April. It is about almost 3 o'clock. It's been raining all day here in Bismarck, which I love the rain, by the way, but a lot of people don't. That's okay. First of all, I'm not an expert. I don't have any certification. I do this for many reasons. One in particular, when I'm interviewing somebody, when I have them on the phone, when I have them sharing on my podcast, a great deal of time, I've never met them. And I'm listening to their story for the first time. And for me, everybody's share means a lot. I learn from everyone. And today I have a gentleman on with me right now named Bill Schneider. You there, buddy?
Yes, sir.
Bill, how are you today? You're in Bismarck, aren't you?
Yes, sir. Doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm well. You know what it's like. I said this a couple of weeks ago. When the temperatures finally go up out here in Bismarck, people start coming out of their houses in shorts and bikes, and it's almost like a parade, isn't it? Because the weather is changing. Isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. It hits that 35, 40-degree mark. You start seeing motorcycles out, and everybody thinks it's summer.
How old are you, Bill?
I'm 42 years old.
Once again, Bill and I have never met. We just talked together for the first time today. I know just a tad bit about Bill, but that doesn't matter. And this is why, once again, this is why I have this podcast. This is why I love it so much when people tell me that they enjoy afterwards sharing their story. I do know this, that Bill has no problem sharing his story because he just did that earlier today, didn't you, Bill?
Yes, sir.
So you got no problem talking to people and telling people your life story and how, first of all, how long have you been sober? What's your sobriety date?
December 27th. So I got 2.5 years. It'll be 3 this December 27th.
Congratulations. You know how that goes. You know the wonderment of staying sober. And you also know, and you've seen it at meetings, you've seen people take tokens. You've seen that gleam in their eyes when they talk about how they got sober. This is one of the reasons why you and I are in this program, because of recovery. What was your drug of choice? Drinking, or you, if you feel comfortable?
All of them.
All of them. Okay. So yeah, drugs and alcohol?
Yeah, so I started out primarily with alcohol when I was probably 10. And then I got into the marijuana at probably the age of... probably 12.
Let me ask you a couple questions. Let me clarify a couple things here. And for those of you who have listened to my podcast before, I sure appreciate it. They also know that I interrupt a lot. And I don't mean to do that to be an a-hole. I interrupt sometimes, Bill, because I want to get right to the question that I have. So I guess for now I'm apologizing for any interrupting that I'm doing. Does that make any sense?
Totally fine by me.
Okay, so you started when you were 10. What kind of family environment did you have?
I had a pretty good family environment. My parents were married when I started, and they got divorced around junior high.
Okay. And did you stay with your mom? Did you go live with your dad? What did you do?
I stayed with my dad for a little bit, and then I ended up living on my own.
Yeah.
In high school.
When you lived with your dad, was it more of a feeling like, hey, maybe I'll have a little bit more freedom with my dad than my mom? Maybe, he'll give me a couple more lengths of rope, so to speak, so I can go out and do stuff with my friends rather than, you know, sometimes moms will be a little bit more strict. Was that about it? Because when I was 12, my parents got divorced, and I had to make a decision a little later on after that who to live with.
So, yeah, the way it kind of turned out is... I lived with my dad just because it was probably more convenient.
Yeah.
He would probably been the more strict one. I've always been with mom's little boy.
Sure. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have 2 sisters, yes.
Are you the oldest one? Are you mid or what?
I'm the baby boy. I'm the youngest.
Okay, I get that. Okay, so you started drinking when you were 10. Was it just kind of hanging out and having some drinks with some friends, or did your parents introduce booze to you? Did they? Because some parents don't mind if you have a beer or two, whatever age you are, you know?
No, so my first drinking experience, I pretty much, I don't know what I was thinking. I've kind of been a knucklehead my whole life.
Yeah.
So I just kind of went to the fridge. I grabbed my dad's, I think there was maybe four left of his six-pack of Miller Pounders, and I grabbed those and a carton of eggs. I jumped on my pedal bike. A couple of my friends, they didn't even want to drink. I just slammed them beers and then threw them in the neighbor's backyard, and then I jumped on my pedal bike and went and egged the school and egged some girl's house that made fun of me.
Okay, first of all, you and I both know that if your dad, is your dad still around?
Yeah, he is, yep.
Is he one of us? Is he in the program? Is he an alcoholic?
No,
is he a drug addict? No?
No.
So he, at that point, probably wouldn't know if you took two beers out of his four left, because damn it, man, I sure would know. I would know if you took, wouldn't you? Aren't you laughing because you know that? If you had four left and someone swiped one of your beers, you would know, wouldn't you? Man, I sure would.
Oh, well, I took whatever's left of the six pack and slammed them all.
Yeah, right.
And they've always had kind of liquor in the house and stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd do the old trick of, you know, I was a beginner, so I'd take out the whiskey bottles, force them out. Or, you know, for myself, and then I'd fill it up, and then it would fog up from the water. So I had a learning curve there.
Why do you think you drank at that age? Did you want to be tough? Did you just think it was, I mean, did you like it? Did you like the taste? Did you like the effect?
So I think I've always kind of drank because, or did drugs at that age. I was just experimenting. My dad had a heavy haul company, so he was gone working a lot. My mom was working a lot. I think it was just mainly boredom.
Right. Summer boredom, so right? You're on summer school. You're not in summer school. You're on summer vacation, and you're looking for something to just do, right?
Right.
Right. And your friends, probably a small group of friends, big group?
I had a pretty big group of friends. I was always kind of, everybody kind of knew me, but I was kind of a spoiled rotten kid. So
yeah.
I kind of became everybody liked me, but I was a social outcast. Nobody wanted to really hang out with me.
Yeah.
So I just kind of, did things to try to fit in, you know, the acting out for attention, being the class clown, that sort of thing.
Did you do well in school?
Not at all.
Yeah. I hated school. Did you like school? I hated it.
Not at all.
Yeah, my teachers were all boring. I only had one teacher that I still remember to this day who instilled me in. He gave me some encouragement to write an essay about something that I enjoyed, which I think was what teachers should do. And every other teacher from every other subject was sheer boring. So I ditched a lot. But I ditched and watched TV. When you were not loving school, did you start drinking more, or what'd you wind up doing?
Well, so after I egged the school and the principal's car and that girl's house and stuff, I got charged with vandalism, and then my family, you know, we're probably your middle class family, they sent me to St. Anne's school.
Okay.
And then that's kind of where I got into smoking weed.
Tell us what was the school called they sent you to?
St. Anne's.
What is that?
Oh, it's just a private school,
okay.
Catholic school here in Bismarck.
It's called what again? I couldn't.
St. Anne's.
St. Anne's. Is that what you said?
Yep.
Okay. Our phone system blows sometimes, but St. Anne's, it's a private school. Is it more of a rigid, strict school where they keep an eye on you?
Yeah, so not really so much like that. And it was a good school. It's not like I brought the drugs to the school. I didn't find the drugs at the school, but
yeah.
It just was the fact of being kind of uncomfortable in a group of my peers, maybe not being socially accepted by them.
Yeah.
So okay. Then the first chance I got, I started smoking pot and kind of ran into a situation where I found a good amount of weed, mm-hmm. and I started selling it at the school to kind of get accepted by everybody there.
Did you find a lot of people that would buy stuff off you?
Yeah. Well, at school, like, kind of just introduced a lot of people to weed.
Oh, did you really?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting because I never saw it when I was in school because I didn't hang around hardly anybody. I just had a few people that I ditched and watched I Love Lucy with and ate roll tacos. What kind of rebel kid was I back then? But, you know, there's different groups. So you were able to sell and tell people about it, and they went and tried it, and they loved it, right? And they gave you money for it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you look at that. So what age were you when you began to think, well, this is fun. Maybe I'll experiment on something else, or maybe I'll start drinking more. Were you still drinking at this point?
You know, just what I could sneak from the folks.
Yeah, right.
But I kind of got into the weed thing and then started selling it.
Okay.
And probably like the seventh, eighth grade.
Yeah.
I was selling quite a bit. And then I would say in ninth grade is kind of when things started to change. That's about when my parents got divorced.
Yeah.
Things living with my dad didn't go well. I'm kind of bullheaded. He's bullheaded.
Yeah.
And then I kind of started getting into heavier drinking.
Yeah.
Through high school, and then started with the doing the harder drugs.
What kind of harder drugs?
So, I started with meth.
Yeah.
And then got in the started selling cocaine.
Wow. Okay. You were selling it, huh?
Yeah. When I was in, I would say my sophomore year is when the change happened. To, mm-hmm. And then I got indicted by the feds my senior when I graduated my senior year.
Well, right before that, were you ever scared that you were going to get caught when you were starting to sell cocaine and things like that?
No.
No. No fear, right?
Right. Well, I don't know if it's no fear, not many brain cells.
Okay. Well, yeah, right. Okay, so tell us, that was like you got indicted, right?
Yeah, so my dad knew there was a problem. My parents knew that I had an issue. So I was selling drugs. I graduated high school.
Okay.
And my dad had me lined up to be shipped out of town because he's just trying to keep me out of trouble.
Right.
So they sent me down custom harvesting with a group of people. And then they we're down there. That started out in Texas. And they the day I graduated, because it was kind of iffy if I was going to even graduate, and I missed so much school. I was living on my own, and they just had enough of it. And they're like, all right, they had this lined up, and they sent me down there.
What was this called?
It was custom combining.
Custom combining, and what is that? That's a placement for people who are in trouble.
No.
Or just what?
Oh, there's plenty of trouble, but what they do is come harvest season.
Okay.
You know, big farmers will just pay people to come and combine their crop for them.
Oh, I got it. You know, I was thinking the other thing, Bill. I thought it was some sort of home for bad people, for people that weren't fitting in. When you said, of course, it was a farming thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
And instead of changing when I went down there, I turned it into a big party in every state I was in.
So everywhere you went, you expressed yourself, so to speak, right?
Well, it just kind of, from a young age, it just kind of showed me wherever you go, there you are. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, we got back up here, towards the end of the summer. You know, you worked your way up, and about, you know, towards August, we were back in North Dakota.
Yeah.
And I just jumped right back into the drugs, you know, again.
Yeah.
And then what kind of happened was, when I was messing with the meth, I didn't drink. So when I got back to doing meth again, I quit drinking, and then that's when the problems really started happening. I had a brand new car, and I was heading over from Bismarck to Mandan, or Mandan to Bismarck, I'm sorry.
Right.
And there's a bar called the Broken Oar.
Yep.
Off the south side of the interstate. And I went and took out that guardrail. I blacked out,
Spun
the car around, and I remember it used to have cables, and the cable came through the windshield and stopped. The only thing I remember is it stopped like a couple inches from my face.
Jeez.
So kind of went on the run from that DUI type thing.
Yeah.
And that's when I did, I met somebody, and we had a drug deal that didn't go well, and I ended up robbing a drug dealer. And I was sitting in county jail, you know, kind of being a smart aleck to law enforcement.
Right.
And that's when I was sitting in county jail. My dad came to visit me, and he was like, "I'm not bailing you out this time." And I was like, "I didn't even ask you to come see me."
Yeah.
He left, and then they were like, "Schneider, pack up your stuff." I packed up my stuff, and that's when they came with a federal indictment. And it wasn't anybody I knew that was sitting there to pick me up. It was U.S. Marshals.
Now, what does that mean? Does that mean you're going to prison?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let me ask you this. This is the intriguing part for me. When they came and got you, did you know how long you were going to be in prison?
No.
Okay. How old were you?
18.
You had been in jail before, but not prison, right?
No, this would have been my first time in jail.
Oh, in jail. Okay. So you hadn't done any of that anyway. So let's bypass jail. Let's take you to prison, right?
Okay.
No, isn't that right? Is that what happened?
No, you had to go to jail until you get sentenced to prison.
Oh, okay. So you were in jail for a little bit, and then you got sentenced to prison. They came and got you, right?
Right, so I was in jail on that strong arm robbery with the drug dealer.
Yeah,
and then while I was sitting in jail, county jail for that, the federal government, the feds came because that was a state case, and then the feds came and indicted me for selling drugs.
All right, you'll have to apologize. I'm gonna have to apologize for a couple things. First of all, how naive I am. Tell everybody what the difference is between jail and prison. I'd like to know.
Well. So, in the United States, you're innocent until you're proven guilty.
Sure.
Is what they say. So, you sit in, if you get arrested and they put you in jail, you normally sit there until you go through your court process.
Okay.
And then they'll come back around and pick you after you get sentenced. After, you know, like, if you ever gotten a DUI.
Yeah.
Or something like that, and then, you know, you go to jail on a serious crime. They normally take you to jail, and someone's either got to post your bond to get out.
Yep.
Or you just kind of sit there until your case goes in front of the judge for sentencing.
Right.
And then they'll sentence you to prison.
Okay. So, but tell everybody, mentally and physically, what's the difference between jail and prison? Is prison that much more harsh? More dangerous, would you say?
Probably up here in North Dakota, but other states have some pretty dangerous county jails, you know, your bigger cities, your metro areas. And then jail is pretty much I don't know, prison is more like, jail is just kind of like you're sitting in a cell block all day playing checkers or whatever you do, and cards or whatever. And then when you get to prison, it's more like the, some of them they're all different, you know, depending on what level you're at.
Yeah.
But some of them you have to go to work every day, you know, and some of them, they're just all different.
and you're young still, and mentally being in a jail or in a prison cell, I don't know if you know this, but lately I've been watching this show on Netflix, if I say that right, Flix. And they were showing some people in prison, 23-1. And I said to myself, what does that mean? Well, I'll tell you what 23-1 means. You know what that means. That means 23 hours in your cell, 1 hour out. How in the hell, Bill, can you be in that environment without going crazy? What did you do? Did you read a lot? What do you do mentally for that when you're in prison behind bars and you cannot go anywhere? How do you do that?
Well, you just figure it out. You know, like the prison I went to I started out in the feds at a medium low because it was my first offense. And then I got, you know, at that prison, you weren't on lockdown 23 hours.
Yeah.
You know, those are your, like, more higher security prisons.
Sure.
And so when I got in a lot of trouble at that first prison.
Right.
For fighting. And then I went to the shoe department, which is the solitary confinement, or they call it the hole.
Yeah.
And then that's when I was locked. I was getting shipped.
Yeah.
And they did an investigation under it because they had these other inside charges against me.
Yeah.
For starting this fight. And then so I actually sat in the hole for like eight months, and that was... That's enough to drive.
Good Lord. Jeez.
Yeah. So, in that time, I just did a lot of reading and kind of do a little workout.
Yep.
And just try to pass the day.
Good grief. Do you come across any booze or drugs in prison or jail? You know, you see some of those movies where those people are able to pass them around. They get them under tow somewhere, and they say that sometimes it's very easy access to get that. Is that true?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Isn't that crazy?
I mean, I don't know how it is out here, but the federal system had a whole big problem with getting drugs in.
You know, I've said this on my podcast before, Bill, and I'll tell you again, for those of you who heard it a million times, when I was at one of my recovery homes way out in the desert, they brought some guys in from jail who were allowed to do this program, and they were gladly in the program so they can get out of jail, and they were living here in this recovery home, and one of them was telling me about jail and prison or whatever, and I said to him, just like I asked you, I said to him, is there booze or drugs? And he goes, oh, yeah, I used to get drunk all the time, and this tells you what an alcoholic I am, Bill. I said to him, that doesn't sound too shabby, man. Sitting in your cell, bombed to hell, drunk as hell. He goes, what are you talking about? And then I thought about it later. It was a pretty stupid thing to say. But at that point, I thought, that doesn't sound too shabby, getting drunk and hanging out in your cell all day. That's pretty pathetic, isn't it, Bill?
Well, I used to do it, so.
No, I know,
yeah,
but
it is.
That's what we do, so, right? That's what we did.
So I ended up getting transferred from there. Waseca was a male federal holding, federal SCI.
Yep.
And then after I got in trouble, I went to, they shipped me to Florence. And that's when I like got into a political yard prison.
Yeah.
And it was a higher security. And there was probably more respect there than a Sunday at church. But when it got violent, that's when I learned that, man, this really might not be how I want to live the rest of my life. You know, like being around race riots and, you know, just being young and naive kid from North Dakota. You don't know about a lot of gang life.
Yeah, you're young. How old are you at this point?
I think I was about 20 by the time I went to Florence.
So you're 20 years old and you're watching all of this violence and you're watching all this craziness going on. You started to think to yourself, do you really want this kind of life?
Right. So, like, I remember, you know, I was always lucky enough to have good people around me.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I look back at it, they've always just kind of been, no matter what I've been doing, I've always had great people in my life, you know?
Yeah.
And when I got there, it was more of the same, you know, like people kind of came up to me and like, hey, how are you? You know, how is it going? This is kind of where you sit.
Yep.
This is, these are the rules because it's very racially segregated.
Okay.
Or it was at that time in the prison system.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I kind of got with some guys that were involved in gang activity in there and kind of just kind of trying to live through it, you know?
Yeah.
And then when it came time, I just remember, like, they used to... when it would riot, like, I just never lived through anything so insane, you know, like, you just got hundreds of guys just getting after it and people getting stabbed, and it was just a scary time.
Yeah.
So, like, they would come down and they would do a profile on you if you got caught up in any of that, and, like, hog tie you up on with zip ties, and you'd just lay there for hours until they came around to you and cleaned up the whole yard.
Yeah, I can't even imagine it. I can't even. I guarantee you, TV and movies don't portray it as violent as you remember in your head. I'm sure, right? I'm sure there's images in your head you probably want to forget forever. Tell us how long you were in prison in a combined time. So, how many times have you been in and out?
So I've been to prison twice.
Okay.
And so that time I did 5 years, okay. And then I got out. I got out, and I just remember, like, there was some crazy stuff that happened right before I got out, and I was, I didn't have any kids at the time, and I was just, like, thinking to myself, like, man, this is not a life I ever want to come back to, you know?
Of course.
And and then it kind of kept me, you know, when I got out, I was out of the drug scene. I didn't even want to touch it anymore.
Yeah.
And but I still drank alcohol, so that kind of landed me. I was out on probation. My dad got me into trucking, hauling equipment.
Yeah.
And kind of did that for a while, and then you know, got a DUI down in Sturgis, and that's where my alcohol addictions got me in trouble again, you know.
Yeah.
And this time I'm on state and federal probation.
Okay.
And it cost me to lose my CDL.
Yeah.
So I there again, it cost me to, you know, fall backwards in life, you know? So it kind of went on, like, I found different jobs and, ended up, getting my CDL back. And while I was, I ended up getting married, I think in like 2008, I had a little baby girl, and I'm not doing any of the drugs, but I'm still drinking, and I had my daughter Zoe, and couldn't get along with her mother, so we got a divorce after like 6 months.
Did you ever think, when you had the divorce, did you ever think back to your parents when they separated? What that was,
you know? I really didn't. My parents' divorce didn't really, I never thought about how the broken, this is all a product of broken home, right?
Right.
So I never really looked back at that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I guess I wasn't mentally, I wasn't there yet.
No, I understand. When you separated with your wife, though, you had a young girl, didn't you? How old was she?
So she was still a baby.
Yeah, baby.
You know, so, yeah, it was a bad deal. And then my best friend hung himself, and he was, right after he got off the phone with me.
Wait, say that again. Your best friend what?
So when I had my daughter, my best friend was struggling, and he kind of called me and is just asked me, like, hey, if I ask you for something, would you give it to me?
Yeah.
And I said, absolutely. And he was supposed to meet me. I knew he was struggling. And, you know, I said, meet me tomorrow for lunch. And he said, of course, I'll be there. And I said, you promise? He said, yeah. And, the part of addiction is a hole in your soul, obsession of in your mind, and a disease of the body. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And I don't really split up the drugs and the alcohol, because it's all, to me, the same thing. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm a gambling addict. You know what I mean? So it took me a long time to figure that out. But at that point, when he killed himself, we were going through our divorce. It all kind of happened at around the same time. And I just gave up on life, you know?
He took his life after he talked to you on the phone, roughly, right?
Right after, yep.
You don't harbor any, you don't get down on yourself to this day that you feel that you could have done anything, do you?
In the past, if that was, let's see here, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
There isn't a day that goes by that I don't think I should have did something different.
Do you ever talk to anybody about what you just told me? Because that's pretty heavy. That's very heavy. That's heavy.
Well, that's part of my story, and that's part of and actually how I live my life now is by helping others, and that I carried with me from 2000. Let's see here. Oh man, I carried that for 15 years.
Yeah,
I carried that with me, and it was after that, like, when I got sober this last time, I was struggling.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when it all came to a head. So I went back in and got into selling. This time I started digging in and selling meth.
Yeah.
I'm selling large quantities of meth, and just kind of gave up on life, running around with, running a criminal activity, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
And, yeah.
And just gave up on life, kind of just getting in trouble with the law, having them raid my house, follow me around, and it was not psychosis, paranoia. It was really what was going on. And in 2014, I had my son. Family.
Right.
With all that was going on, I wasn't ready to be not in any way, shape, or form, ready to have another child. I was, coming in and out of my daughter's life, and, I have my son with the same person. So it just kind of became a thing of one day, after Christmas in 2015, I came up with this idea, like, hey, I'm going to leave town. I was already kind of burnt up in town, like, just not working, selling drugs, gambling. And at this point, I just told my, actually, it was one of the worst days of my life is, I told my daughter that, hey, dad's going to go away, and it might be a real long time until you see him again. So how that kind of went was in March of 2015, I left town, and I got pulled over by the BIA. About 15 miles, right on the north side of 48th, I'd say halfway between the casino and Prairie Nights and 48th.
Yeah.
I got pulled over, and I had a misdemeanor warrant, and I had somebody else's ID, driver's license.
Yeah.
And we passed for each other, and I had my motorcycle in the back of the pickup, and somebody called me in for suspicious activity.
Yeah.
And this is where my life changed. This is where the rubber met the road. I go in, get pulled over, and it went bad, and I ended up going, dragging the cop. We had gotten into a scuffle. I jumped back in the pickup, and he started hitting me, and then kind of just took off, and he ended up getting dragged down the road for a little ways.
Oh.
And kind of a miracle that he's alive, that he lived through it,
yeah.
You know, because that would have been bad.
Yeah.
But that's where, you know, I just needed that moment of, I was just not in a good spot in life. I was selling drugs and doing drugs and just running down a dead-end road. So that happened. I went on a high-speed chase for a couple hours and hit some spike strips, and it gave me a second chance at life, you know. Went to jail, fought the case, and ended up getting 5 years for assault on a federal officer. And then I went to Oxford, Wisconsin, in the federal prison system. And that's where, like, I started getting into making wine and moonshine, and just got in just to pass the time. I was just really in a bad way because the feeling of failing my kids and not being in their life just kind of killed me. So that's kind of how that all went. I didn't sober up in prison. I actually became more of a alcoholic, you know.
Anybody come and visit you while you were doing all that time?
Being that far away, my mom and my kids came once.
Yeah.
And just when it came time to leave, I'll never forget my daughter. My son was awful young, and he was awful little.
Yeah.
But my daughter cried so hard, and she just has always said, "Dad, I don't want you to leave." And I just told my parents after that, like, I told my mom after that, don't bring them back here, you know. Just to see my kids like that was hard, you know.
That's got to happen all the time. That's got to happen with others that you talk to in jail, in prison. That's got to be that's got to be one of the most gut-wrenching feelings in the world.
Oh, yeah. When I came out of that visit, like, you know, it didn't matter what race they were. They, you know, it's all right, Billy, and give you a hug, you know. And,
yeah.
And it's, but it is definitely one of the hard things for me to talk about is how much pain I've caused my kids. You know, like I said, I got two great kids. So I got out of prison, and in 2019, and I had a job waiting for me out in New Salem. I moved out there and started in, and I was doing good for like 6 months.
Yeah.
I was on house arrest, and here I go. I started drinking again.
Do you remember? And, you remember how you started? Do you remember something telling you, "Hey, you know what? I miss it." Did you miss it? Did you just want to feel good again? I mean,
just living out there and being bored and not much going on. I just walked over to the bar.
Yeah.
Started drinking.
Yeah.
And then, you know, getting back to it, I end up doing drugs again. And I'm not selling, but I'm on federal probation.
Yeah.
And I, you know, to this day, I text my probation officer.
Yeah.
Lee, and I'm just telling him how great of a person he is, because I had a ended up going to a trucking company and doing heavy haul, and my boss Brad has been in that. He actually bought that business from my dad, and Brad gave me an opportunity to do this, and he actually has like, I don't know, 40 some, maybe, I don't want to age the guy too much, but he's got a lot of time in sobriety in the program.
Right.
So, my probation officer lets me ride on it. One day he's like, I don't know what to do with you. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, I'm not going to throw you back in prison. And he's like, but is this really how you want to live the rest of your life?
Yeah.
And I said, no, it's not.
Yeah.
And he said, okay. He ended up putting me back in center in the halfway house here.
Mm-hmm.
And I got kicked out a week later because I got COVID.
Got COVID, yep.
So this is where, you know, the rubber met the road. Again, like, I don't have, I'm bored. I don't know how I'm going to stay sober. I'm going to meetings. I don't want to go to meetings.
Yeah.
I don't think I want to be, you know, I'm just at the point where I have to stay sober for a year to get off probation.
Because you're constantly being tested, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I just don't know how it looks or how I can do it, you know, because I just, and what happens is I go to my friend's house. And this just so happens to be close to my buddy's reunion date of him
taking his life.
Killing, yep. And then his twin sister, I go there and she's like, you know, I'm so sick of this. Yeah. And this is what really made me take a look at myself. And I said, what are you sick of? And she's like, there's conversations I need to have with you that I can't. And I'm like, okay, why can't you? And she said, because you and my brother, and we're like all close friends. And she said, I can't even talk to the person that we love between us the most without you absolutely breaking down. And I was like, So I was like, well, all right. You know, and I was like, you know, she's like, it's not your fault. And I was like, well, I could have done something different, you know. He'd asked me a question, and I told him I'd give him anything, and he took it as I give him permission to do it, you know. And and that just kind of wore. And she's like, I'm sick of it. You have to figure it out, man, because I can't even talk to you about him. And I was like, all right. So I went home that night, and I know him too, and she told me, like, he would never want you to live like this. And I went home and I wrote down a letter.
Mm-hmm.
I just said, like, hey, man, I know you wouldn't want me to feel like this. I said, if there's anything I can do for you, let me know. And something came on TV. I had some music playing on TV, and a commercial came on about suicide prevention. You know, so I was sitting, I went to an AA meeting. And I'm sitting in AA, and I was talking about, like, hey, this was kind of a weird synchronicity or whatever. And somebody was sitting in there said, hey, would you come speak at a meeting? So I went and spoke at one of these meetings, a suicide prevention meeting. And after I spoke, somebody came up to me and said, hey, you know, just by you telling me what it's like for the people around you, or around us, you know, how it affects their lives. I just want you to know you saved my life today.
Wow.
And at that point, I wasn't working a real spiritual program.
Right.
My alcoholism, drug addiction, actually, I was about the most insane sober person you ever met. Like, I was more angry than I'd ever been in my life. And I just, my controlling behaviors came back up, right? So just waiting for that moment, you know, like where something, because you see happy people in the program, but why can't I be happy? You know, the urges went away, or the, you know, the urges for the drink or the drug went away, the cravings, but the happiness and the calmness was not there. I was more controlling and more fearful than I had ever been in my life.
Yeah.
So, long story short, I had an individual in my life that I was not getting along with. I worked for him, and one day, I will always appreciate this man because he is the man that just there was a problem, and that problem gave me a second, a glimmering second of hope that that something outside of myself could relieve the insanity and take away the anger. So I just right then and there, I hit my knees. And when I hit my knees, I said, God, if you're real, I need you to take this from me because I can't handle it, dude. I cannot do this on my own anymore. And whatever you look like, I need this gone. And it was like, this was probably like 3 months into my sobriety.
Yeah.
My sponsor did a good job working the steps with me. And that's a different, that's another thing I did, you know. Before I'd kind of look at the people in AA and be like, scoff at them, you know, like you guys are less than, or you guys aren't capable, or however that looks, right? But this time I had to stay sober, so I was going to do everything right. I was gonna get a sponsor, and I did, and I was going to go through the book, and
look,
I did.
Look what you
and
just did. You just did step one. You did step two. Of course, you came to believe that a power greater than yourself, you knew that could restore us to sanity. You had already made a decision to turn your will and your lives over to the care of God as we understood them, as you understood them. How about that? How'd that make you feel? How strong did that make you feel? And that's a pretty incredible thing, isn't it? That's just not by design, yep. You know. That's a God thing. That's our higher power thing by far.
Well, as I'm a very extreme person in life, so
right.
It was kind of funny because it all had to happen, and to put it all into linear time is kind of hard to do because it all happened at once, and I was actually on my step three.
Yeah.
When this all happened.
Sure.
So it was all by my higher power's design, right?
Yeah.
It was all by God's design. So going into it, one of my buddies was like, hey, I want you to be the godfather to my son. And I said, all right. He said, but I want you to go to church with us. And I was like, yeah, no.
Yeah.
And he's like, it became a big argument, long story short.
Yeah.
It ended up with me just leaving, but saying I'll go to church for this purpose. So I went to church, and you know, growing up in a Catholic school and stuff, I just had so many like reservations in my mind. And what happened was I went to church and I got this tingling in my head.
Right.
And I told my buddy, I was like, man, I'm not feeling good. I got this tingling. And he's like, oh, that's the Holy Spirit. And I'm like, yeah, that's enough for me. Kind of like I got up and, you know, even though like this anger got removed, I still like think I did it on my own and my pride and ego showing up. And I was like, hey, man, I'm good. So I went back to church the next week just to make sure that that's what it wasn't. You know what I mean? Make sure it wasn't the Holy Spirit.
Right.
God, you know, and I go back to church and sure enough, I get it stronger than the last time. So then that same friend, I had to go admit this to him, that I was wrong, you know, that there is a power greater than me.
Yeah.
And by doing that, he's like, hey, do you want to go to this program called Shop Talk? And I was like, what is it? And he's like, oh, it's just a group of guys that get together and I was like, all right, sounds good. And I go down there, and that's where my life really took a turn.
What do you guys talk about? Tell everybody, because we're not sure. It's called Shop Talk? Shop Talk?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's Shop Talk, and it's down at some guy, this Steve Skipple shop. And I don't know what it is. I walk in there, and it's a Bible study type deal.
Okay.
And that's why he didn't tell me what it was, because he knew I wouldn't go.
Right.
But I went there, and what you do is you, you know, it doesn't matter what denomination you are.
Right.
There's all sorts of different kinds of people that go there, alcoholics, business owners, just a different walks of life show up there.
Yeah.
And you just, you watch a clip on TV,
mm-hmm.
and then afterwards, everybody just kind of goes around and talks about it, you know? And, you know, when I went there, I had somebody just come up to me and put their hands on me and just say, hey, you have something big coming up in your life? And it got to kind of follow through with it. So leaving there, my buddy's like, do you know what just happened to you? I was like, yeah, I'm sure they do that to every person there for the first time. And he's like, no, I've never seen it the whole time I've been here. So I kind of have, my old boss, Brad Meyer, and Clayton Meyer, their offices are in the same building. Well, Clayton was an arresting officer before, and I'd be, under the influence when I go talk to Brad, and I would just kind of stay away from Clayton because I knew he was the next cop, you know? So one day Clayton calls me in his office, and I go, and at this time I'm sober though, and this is after I go to Shop Talk, and I start going there on a regular basis. And Clayton's, like, talking to me, and he has, I think, probably, he's got around, like, 38 years, I would say, in the program. So he's one of my main mentors in life, and that's kind of what got me going on, when God took that anger from me and removed that, you know, me living in a straight, fearful state, I was just like, I kept on asking, what do you want to do? What do you want me to do for you? So one of my old probation officers, I bump into him, Mark Kemet, and he's like, hey, what are you doing for kids? I'm like, man, nothing. I used to go speak at YCC.
Yeah.
But it's like, as soon as I speak there, it's out of sight, out of mind, you know?
Right.
And I'm like, pretty extreme. So like, if I'm just going to go talk about it, I need to be about it. Right.
Right.
So I'm just kind of, going through the motions, and I'm pretty new with this higher power thing, but like people are just keep on bombarding me kind of like just with like, hey, I just keep on having kids do something for these kids, you know, like, wouldn't it be great if we could stop addiction before it started? You know? So I kind of have that on my mind. And one day it just comes to me like, hey, we have these programs like AA, NA, GA, all sorts of them, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, wouldn't it be great if I set up, I didn't do it, but God just put it on my heart like, hey, let's set up a mentoring program for these kids.
What age group are you talking about?
All of it.
Okay. All kids age.
I mean, as long I don't know. I don't do the diaper thing, so.
Yeah.
So how it was kind of put on me is like, hey, let's start this. When did I start? When did I really go? And I came up and I'm like, came up with this idea one morning, and I'm like, I'm going to get maybe four go-karts.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go out to YCC and tell them, hey, give me four of your worst case scenarios.
Yeah.
The kids that you can't reach. And it just kind of, I went back and I ran and told Clayton, one of the arresting officers, I was like, hey, man, this is what I'm going to do. And he starts laughing at me. And I was like, is it a bad idea? And he's like, I think it's an amazing idea. Can I be part of it?
Yeah.
So he's involved. And then Mark Kemet, the old probation officer, he currently works in he's still in the correction system or corrections field. Yeah. He tells me, I tell him, I was like, hey, do you want to be involved in this? You kind of help plant the seed. And he's like, yeah, let me see about it. And, and he comes back around and he's like, yeah, I'm in. So, I meet this gal, Andra, and she's like, we talk about it and she's like, I'm in too. So that was, later on we run into Dan Jones and he gets involved in it. And, he doesn't have any, addiction in his life. So he's not really sure how this works. I just tell him, hey man, just jump on. I'm just, ride it out and see what you think. So then how it turns out is one day, I go walk into Clayton's office. I'm like, Clayton, I think we're going to need something. People keep on talking about a 501c3.
Yeah.
So he slides over this Frank Hunkler's number. And that guy has just kind of done a lot of them. And he actually told us what he needed. And we just got it going for him. And I think next thing you know, he was kind of telling us, hey, this might take a couple years. And I was like, yeah, it's not going to take that long, though. And I think it was all done pretty much within a year. So the 50C was written, or the 501C3 was written, and it was such a learning experience, you know, coming up with the curriculum. And then that's when we came up with, like, okay, well, the outline of how it works, you know, having different stages of it, you know what I mean?
Right. And this is called what? Tell everybody what this is called again.
Oh, Destination Elevation.
Destination
Elevation.
Destination. Elevation.
Yeah.
And underline that. And what is the main purpose of this? To help out kids, to keep them from becoming involved with addiction?
Right. So it's just it's being proactive instead of reactive.
Sure.
Because as you can tell with my story, I've been through, a point in my life, sober, addiction, sober, going back out.
Yeah.
You know, just the back and forth. So I was like, what can we do to change that? And it's like, hey.
How amazing do you think that this is, if you think about it, from where you came from, the rough early years you had? I mean, you started out young. You went to prison and all that, served time. Now look what you're doing. Don't you think it's pretty amazing that you're a role model for kids?
Well, I think it's amazing that I turned my life over to my will over to my higher power.
Oh, absolutely. And look what you've done with it.
It's all him. It's not me. It's he's brought everybody in my life to do it. And he works through all the people around us. And it's all the glory is to him, not me. When I'm running the show, I end up going down the wrong street. So just being to a point where I was willing to do whatever he puts in front of me, right?
Well, check it out. What was your best friend's name that took his life?
Ryan.
I guarantee you Ryan is with you every time you do this. I guarantee you. He's on your shoulder. He's on your left shoulder.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people when we talk about that kind of thing that are guiding us together as a unit. And I've had the opportunity to help some kids out. And, I can say is, you know, if we can get to that kid at the first age of acting out.
Yep.
Acting out in school, the attention seeking, or fighting, violence, truancy, however that looks, and get with that kid because they're just missing something.
Okay, can people look you guys up on Google? Destination Elevation, can they look up your program through there?
Yeah, they can look, they can find us on, we have a website.
And is this something that they can, you know, after they get the information they need, can they just show up and they can introduce themselves to you?
Right, yeah, and then we have an application and process and a referral process.
Okay.
So, you know, I had been working with a kid that kind of went full circle in the program, and he was like, you know, I would like to, I want to help other people, just like you. And I was like, well, right, this is how we do it. And just kind of showing them the steps we take in life. And, you know, it's a lot easier. I can't say it's a lot easier. I would say it's a lot more effective if we can get to them before that first drug and drink does.
Of course, but sometimes it's not that easy. Does anybody ever say to you, why are you doing this, Ryan? I'm sorry, Bill. Bill, why are you doing this? What is your answer? I want to know your answer to that. I'm sure you look at him with a smile and you say, if you can only see my heart right now through my skin.
What I tell him is, I was a weak man in my addiction and committing crimes or violence or anything I did. I was totally weak. But that's the one that, you know, the good Lord above chose to fulfill his mission, because he knows that the weaker you are when you come to him, you have to fill that void with faith. So it takes all you got love and fear in your heart. It takes out the fear and replaces it with faith.
Yeah. Well, you know, he picked the perfect man, because here's the thing. You've lived it. You've gone through pain. You lost your friend. You've seen violence. You've been through alcohol and drugs and police activity and on the run, basically. And, you know, you got to think sometimes of when you're by yourself. And it sounds to me like you probably say to yourself, why me? But I love the fact that you're getting, but I'm sure now that you've been doing this, for how long have you been doing this now?
So we've been at, you know, with the whole getting the 501c3, we've been going at it for about 2 years.
That's amazing. So what I'm trying to tell you is, I'm sure when you think to yourself, because you had said minutes ago, that sometimes at first you're probably thinking, you know, I'm not worthy or why me? Well, our higher power knows why you, because you're the right guy to lead younger kids into a better life. Because, man, I tell you, as you know, Bill, the first years of doing stuff and bad stuff, and it can lead into more and more and more, it just snowballs and tumbles, and that's the life that we ran. When you're doing this program and you're teaching them the right things and feeling good about yourselves, what a great thing that is to rest your head on your pillow and think about. I mean, do you ever give yourself a pat on the back and think about how awesome that is, what you're doing?
Well, I would say I give, you know, like my mentors the pat on the back, you know, like Frank, Clayton, the whole list of them, goes Dale, Karen.
Sure.
I got I probably have like 10 people around me guiding me, you know, like,
yeah. Hey,
you know, helping me stay, because sometimes it's not the easiest thing, you know. You know, we get, you know, sometimes there's the kids that we can't save or help, you know, and them are the tough times. So,
I'll bet.
I see it like this, like our purpose is to walk each other home, right?
Right.
Our calling, our specific calling, is to use any pain or hardships that we've lived through in our life.
Right.
To make sure that other people don't have to live that same way.
Well, you wonder, though, the kids you can't reach at this moment, you hope that that one day those kids will turn around and reach the direction you want them to. And you know that's possible, don't you? Because that's how your life kind of went. It was rough for a while.
I would say to anybody, you know, like if you're at the point of giving up, that's and just surrendering to something better than outside of yourself.
Yeah.
That's where it's at. Like, the struggle is real. I've been there. 11 different treatments or treatment programs.
That's
some of them intensive.
Yep.
And it's like when don't ever think there's not hope.
No. Well,
but I would just ask that before, you know, you got people that are homicidal or suicidal.
Yeah.
Before you reach that point, if you could do one thing, is just hit your knees and ask your higher power to come through into your heart. That could be that is the game changer for me.
I've been there, Bill. I've been there many times where I thought there was no hope. So I continue on that day by day drinking and feeling my blood pressure boil and wonder when it was the time that I was going to stroke out or whatever. Because I had no hope, because I didn't think there was a way. There is no way out. I think you have an incredible story. Let me ask you this. When you were bringing me almost to tears when you were telling me one of the worst days in your life was your daughter crying uncontrollably. How is that today? Do you see her, your kids?
You know, good question. So that's part of the story I kind of skipped over. So when I started doing where I sell my heart from God, and I call him God. I don't mean to offend anybody.
No, you're good.
And just trying to live a life like Jesus did. When I did that, that's, you know, like, there's a lot of hard stuff that came with it.
Yeah.
My daughter actually told me a few months before that I wasn't her dad, that she hated me.
Sure.
And she quit talking to me for 2 years.
Okay.
And then the next time I talked to her was, she said, she called me and she said, Dad, will you come get me? So, yeah, I've had custody of my daughter and my son now for about a year and a half. So, yeah, I get to talk to her. It's pretty cool being a career criminal. And, you know, there's so much that God will do. He gave me a great... He opened up so many opportunities with JNS Heavy Haul, and then opened up another opportunity with Barnhart Crane and Rigging.
Yeah.
And then that just kind of, everything has just, you know, even in the struggle, that's, you know, when the hard times come with relationships or whatever, that's where God is putting on the armor to go do this, his will.
Right.
Is how I see it. So I kind of got used to some of the hard things. You know, my kids are definitely such great human beings. Being a single dad and working on this program, it takes a lot of time from them. But, you know, there's no way I can tell you how great having a good family, even though it didn't work out. And I have two, I just... Like I said, I've been blessed with the best two sisters. I am my parents' favorite child, and I'm sorry to tell my sisters that, but no, they are cool. They I joke with them about that all the time. But I had two great sisters, and my mom and my dad are both great people, you know. And just being blessed. And the thing I have to admit to myself is, I was the one that. Created my own life, right? But within all that, there is a higher power that's just lining you up. And if you'll do that, higher power's will, whatever hardships you've been through, he will use that to help other people through it. Because what I found out is I can live in myself, in my own mind.
Yeah.
And when I'm in my own mind, my own head, and this is all since I've turned my will and life over to God, I can still go down the wrong path, right? So when I do that, I just have to go out and help somebody and just realize that, you know what, this isn't all about me. This is about what I can do for you. And that's probably why you do this podcast, I'm guessing.
Well, like I've said a million times, the strength is not me in this podcast, not even close. It's people like you, Bill, that come on. It's people like you that have stories where it's climbing out of the darkest days and rebuilding your confidence, rebuilding your life, restoring relationships. And that's a wonderful thing. And like you said, our higher power brings us to that. I like what you said. You said God putting on his armor. Is that what you said earlier?
So when I go out, and it's not all rainbows and sunshine.
No.
There are bad things that come up. And like I said, you know, like sometimes you're really trying to help somebody.
Yeah.
And it might not seem to them like you're trying to help them.
Right.
You know, but that's where we have to live outside of ourselves.
Right.
You know, and I just, there are so many people out there willing to help, you know, like.
There really are. There really are.
Kurt Chaffee, Pastor Kurt at New Song, took me under his wing. And that's where he told me, he said, God will give you tools and he'll give you weapons.
Yeah.
You know, because this is not only is it a war on drugs.
Yeah.
It's a war on fear.
Yeah. Well, listen.
You know what I mean?
Keep doing what you're doing, Bill. Keep being.
Thank you, sir.
Of course. What you're doing for younger kids is so crucial. I don't even think that the majority of people when they get older really want to do anything to help kids out for anything more than just you know, being a good parent or this or that, or taking them to a ball game or whatever, spending time on what you're doing is you're right there in the grit, and you're showing these kids how life could be really bad or it could be really good, and you're trying to avoid them from getting into the world of addiction. You know how huge that is? That's just gigantically huge. If that's a word, gigantically huge. Again, tell everybody the program again. I want everybody to know so they can Google it. Tell everybody the program again.
Destination Elevation.
Yeah, please do me a favor, Bill, and let your two sisters and your family hear this and hear what a great guy you are. Will you do that for me when we're done and I send this to you? Will you let your parents hear it?
Well, it's all my family. They've never given up on me.
No, I know that. I know that. I want them to hear what kind of story that you've gone from rough to helping people. Not everybody can say that. Is that cool with you?
That's cool with me.
Bill, you're an awesome guy. I really appreciate you sharing with my audience what your story is all about.
Thank you, guys, and thank you for your time.
I know that you shared a lot. How often do you think you speak?
How often do I speak?
Yeah.
I try to do at least once a month at Heartview, sometimes a couple times, 2-3 times, depending on when they need me to come in or ask me to come in. And any time that I can help somebody with my story, just to walk them home, man, get them on board, and, you know, and that's what it's all about, you know.
Well, I'll bet you I can fill this blank. The greatest feeling in the world is the blank is when someone comes up to me and says, I heard you speak about 2 or 3 years ago and you changed my life. Isn't that the greatest feeling, Bill?
The greatest feeling is just doing whatever God puts on my heart.
Yeah, you hang on, Bill. Awesome guy. You see, that's why I love this podcast so much. Different stories, different shares, different ways of people becoming sober, changing their life of addiction. It truly is a way of life, a miracle. I say it's a miracle for me every single day I wake up sober. And for you, for anybody who's suffering, for your neighbors or your loved ones or yourself, thank you for listening to this podcast. I hope you share it with others, because my name is Brummel. There is a way out.